Paul Gordon, attorney registration number 21860, on behalf of the panel. Just real quick, I get tremors in my neck, so if my head starts doing this, I mean no disrespect to anyone.
No, that's fine.
It seems to me that one of the most interesting issues in this case is whether merely alleging a breach of contract or being able to allege a breach of contract claim triggers the economic loss rule, regardless of whether that claim survives. But I think the law and this court should dig further into assessing why that claim might fail. For example, there's a difference between the formation of a contract and a breach of contract. And if the reason a breach of contract claim fails is because it was never formed in the first place, then the economic loss rule should not survive. But on the other hand, if the breach of contract claim fails because there was an affirmative defense and the statute of limitations ran, then maybe, well, under those circumstances, the economic loss rule would bar the tort claims. But this is a case where the breach of contract claim arguably failed because of there was lack of certainty in the contract. Well, certainty is an element in the formation of the contract. It's an essential element. No certainty means no contract, and that means no economic loss rule applies. So I would submit to you that the trial court erred in concluding that the economic loss rule applied to the tort claims. But I'm going to jump back to the original question then, is should the breach of contract claim have failed in the first place? The element that lacks certainty was the consideration being a piece of the pie, and while I certainly find that to be vague personally, that's not what the law says. The law says that's the kind of term of a contract that a trial court can insert and fill out with principles of equity and fairness and reasonableness under the circumstances.
Well,
so
where do we draw the line between a trial court filling out a vague term and actually writing a contract for the parties? Where is the line between those two?
Honestly, I don't know. It seems like how vague is vague and where do you cross that line? But some of the cases that I found cited in the brief were you could actually fill in a provision. I think one of the cases, you know, had to do with paying for certain supplies. And there was no provision in the contract for who was supposed to pay for certain supplies. And I think ultimately the answer has to be that if the intent of enforcing contracts as a whole is to enable the parties to a contract to have some certainty and the ability to predict what they're going to do with their money and their behavior and whether that should comply with the terms of the contract, then I think you can, and once you find that enforcing the contract meets those policy reasons, then the court can step in and say, well, we will inject here a certain amount of reasonableness given the totality of the circumstances and what may have been intended by the parties. So while I think that it's really vague territory, I do think the law supports the proposition that there is a way, an analysis by which courts can step in. So looking at the case law, a phrase like a piece of the pie, while certainly not normal language in a contract, is sufficient to communicate an intent of the parties to form a contract, in which case, since we're under Rule 12 standards here, the trial court erred in dismissing the breach of contract.
Was there any understanding in this contract about when it was to be performed?
Whether it needed to be performed within 1 year?
Well, or were there any expectations at all about when it would be performed? Because I was having a hard time finding.
I don't think there was a time was out of the essence kind of clause. What actually happened is Mr. Sanders just jumped in right away and started doing the work.
And but when was he to receive, how much work was he to have done before he received the unspecified ownership interest?
I don't think that was decided either. It was his impression that he would jump in and do the work because we're now sort of business partners and that's what business partners do, and that these details would work themselves out in time. As it turned out, he got all the way through the project and then is saying, okay, where's my piece of the pie? But I don't think there was ever an articulation. At least I can't say there's an articulation from what's in the record, which is the complaint, since we're under Rule 12 standards. Might there have been greater detail that people will remember once they get under oath? I don't know. The next issue is this business of whether or not Mr. Sanders was or could have argued in good faith that he was an at-will employee under the circumstances. It's important to understand here that there's a difference between the original agreement, which had Mr. Sanders working as a welder, and then the work that went beyond that original agreement. It's the work beyond the original agreement that is subject to this argument that it could constitute an at-will employment relationship, triggering the statutory rights under the Wage Claim Act and the FMLA under those. I knew I shouldn't have tried. So once you take a look at the fact that we're beyond the scope of the original contract, all bets are off. We don't really know for sure under Rule 12 standards whether we have sufficient information to get past Rule 56 or to get it past a directed verdict, but we do have sufficient information to get it past Rule 12. Finally, Your Honors, there was the argument that perhaps in the alternative we just didn't do an adequate investigation under Rule 11. I think you could always come up with more ideas of places you can go to find information. But all we said in our to the trial court was, these are issues that are subject to discovery, and that's what the trial court latched onto. And I think that was error on the part of the trial court. Merely because we didn't conduct more discovery doesn't mean we didn't adequately investigate the claims before we filed the notice of protest. Thank you.
I think it's on the front.
It's fine. May it please the court, my name is Timothy Odell, number 35771. I represent the defendants below, which are All Around Grouseabout, Reliable Field Services, and Ace Energy Services, all LLCs, and one individual, Ashton Jansen. Plaintiff's counsel and plaintiff below stated that it's an interesting issue whether alleging a contract triggers the economic loss rule, and I would respectfully submit that, of course, the answer is yes. The plaintiff is the master of his complaint, and here the plaintiff pleaded this is first claim of breach of contract claim. The plaintiff, in his complaint, stated that there was a contract, there was an agreement. Now, whether that claim ultimately survives is an issue that has no impact on whether the economic loss rule applies. A contract could be pleaded and ultimately dismissed at trial, ultimately dismissed on summary judgment, or is here ultimately dismissed on a motion to dismiss for failure to allege specific terms or sufficient terms to state that a contract that the plaintiff could prevail on the claim.
Okay, let me ask you this question, Mr. Odell. If the plaintiff had analyzed the situation and decided that what he had was really too vague to be a contract, but maybe he had some quantum error and some unjust enrichment claims, and so he didn't allege a breach of contract, in that situation, would the economic loss rule come into effect or no?
Yes, Judge Boris. As the Colorado case law and the economic loss rule provides, and specifically the BRW case, even Town of Alma, when the doctrine was first added to the Colorado law, as well as Grinberg, states that the issue is whether the duty is an independent one of an agreement. If plaintiff chose to characterize his case as not a breach of contract case, it was still based upon a duty that's created by an agreement, then the economic loss rule would apply.
Can you tell me where?
Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, can you tell me where in BRW you're reading that the holding in that case says the economic loss rule applies whether there's a contract or not?
Your Honor, the test that I was referring to is the three-part test. And well, first, the policy is to maintain the distinction between contract and tort law. The second is to enforce expectancy interests, and then to encourage parties to consider contracts. And the effect of each as they form an agreement. So then looking again at the, to answer your question, Your Honor, The Makoto case, which refers to BRW, states that an independent duty is not shown simply because the plaintiff can point to a duty that exists outside the contract. So here, I read that to mean that whether the plaintiff pleads a contract or not, if there's an agreement, that's what the court looks to as to whether the duty arises from that agreement or not.
But isn't the agreement that they're talking about a contract? That's why they're saying we're talking about differentiating and trying to reconcile somehow contract law and tort law. If there is no contract, how does contract law apply?
Well, the agreement is what the court looks to, Your Honor. The test is whether the duty is independent of an agreement. If the alleged promise that that the claimant claims is giving rise to a common law independent duty is based upon an agreement he has with the other party, then that is a contract. And the defendant could say there was an agreement that encompasses our arrangement, and therefore the economic offer applies, and his remedy is merely a contractual one, not a common law one.
So if the parties characterize something that occurs between the two of them as a contract, but it doesn't meet any of the requirements of a contract, the fact that they're saying it's an agreement, even though it's really not a contract, that also triggers the economic loss rule?
If it is in this case, if the duty is simply that you didn't do something you said you were going to do, that's a contract. And that is what creates the duty. If there were additional things that was allegedly not occurred other than performance of the agreement, then perhaps Your Honor would be correct. But in this case, what's pleaded is, I was promised a piece of the pie. That basis, that factual basis, is the basis for the breach of contract claim, and as well as, without anything more, the basis of every other tort claim that's asserted in the case.
Well, can you tell me what that means, a piece of the pie?
I cannot. It's not sufficient to form anything other than what the plaintiff characterizes as an agreement.
Well, then let's assume, just hypothetically, that the contract lacks certainty, that we can't tell that there was a contract. All right? Despite what you're saying, would we apply the economic loss rule?
I would turn the court back again to what I stated before, the agreement.
But you're going back to agreement, and I'm saying I'm not sure that's clear, certain.
Yes, Your Honor, and that is
that's obviously the challenge here, right?
Understood. That's a question for determination in the case, but simply because the claim later fails does not mean that there was no agreement upon which the economic loss rule would apply. The issue is, what is the remedy? And if there was an agreement, the remedy for a breach of that agreement is a contractual one. That's what plaintiff here pleaded, is that there was a breach of contract based upon an agreement to receive a piece of the pie. Then plaintiff proceeded to, based upon the same conduct, plead several other tort claims. And that's what's not permitted. So the trial court did the analysis and steps, and that's the appropriate way to look at it. First, plaintiff is in control of his complaint. Plaintiff pleaded as he intended to or wanted to. He had full discretion on how to plead the case. Pleaded a breach of contract. Then, based upon identical conduct, asserted tort claims. So, as the Colorado Supreme Court states, the test we look to in BRW, and my apologies, Judge Asprey, I didn't have this at the ready when I answered your question a moment ago, but the three-factor test I was intending to respond to your question with is whether the relief sought in tort is the same as the contractual relief. So in this case, the relief sought was a remedy for the breach of the promise of a piece of the pie. Second factor is whether there's a recognized common law duty of care, and whether the third factor is whether the tort duty differs in any way from the contractual. Here, the issue is only that the alleged wrong for each of the claims for the breach of contract was you didn't provide me a piece of the pie. For each of the tort claims, you didn't provide me a piece of the pie. So it fails that test in BRW when we look at the facts pleaded here. The complaint is straightforward in that there's one paragraph that controls or provides what the alleged factual basis is for each of the claims, and that's paragraph 9. And that appears in the record at page 5. the complaint. So that would be page 7 of the record, is paragraph 9. The statement there is that defendant Jansen told the plaintiff that he had spoken with his business partner and that they agreed that the plaintiff was entitled to a piece of the pie for setting up the new divisions. And then it continued, defendant Jansen told the plaintiff that he would receive an ownership interest in the defendant's business entities in return for his work in setting up and supervising the two new divisions. That's it for a factual basis for each of the claims. Then looking at the first claim, the breach of contract claim, it's based upon an oral contract wherein the defendants agreed to give the plaintiff an ownership interest in the enterprise in return for the plaintiff's work in setting up two new divisions. The second claim for negligent misrepresentation is based upon giving false information, which is the same information referred to in the breach of contract claim. The third is that the plaintiff would receive compensation for setting up two new divisions. Again, the same issue. With respect to fraud, the only factual basis is that that original promise stated in the breach of contract claim was not performed, which cannot be a basis for a fraud claim or an independent duty for a fraud claim, as the Makoto claim case states. So each of the way this case was pleaded, each of the tort claims are based upon an identical promise that the breach of contract claim is. And that answers the question as to what analysis the court looks to, and that's what the trial court properly did.
I'd like to move really fast to the Rule 11 alternative, possible alternative basis for dismissal. And I guess what I'd like to ask was, did the court make any specific finding that the pleadings were insufficient as far as alleging the roles of Jansen and Ace, or did it simply note in one of the pleadings the plaintiff's allegation that they needed more discovery to flesh out those roles?
The court certainly found the statement that discovery was needed to be a telling representation, but the actual analysis the court performed was simply to look at the complaint. And I would represent, as I have in the brief, that there's simply no allegation that impacts any conduct of Ace or Jansen. And the court looked to that to make its analysis that there was no fact alleged against either of these defendants, and that is what constitutes an improper investigation prior to pleading.
Is dismissal a typical sanction for a Rule 11 violation? I mean, I think I've seen a lot of cases where they award attorney's fees, but it seems like a litigation ending sanction is fairly severe.
Right, and Rule 15 certainly contemplates that. In this case, the plaintiff did never ask to amend his complaint, even faced with the Rule 11 letter from myself with the motion to dismiss, and then didn't request leave to amend in his motion to reconsider. The trial court certainly could have considered on a motion for leave to amend exactly what you referred to, Your Honor, but that did not occur below. Finally, with respect to the issues that Judge Boras raised in the first part of the argument, Judge Boras asked where is the line in determining what's a contract, and respectfully, the Stice case does provide what the line is. It tells us we need to know when the obligation arises, when and how the performance is to be made or the claim is to be paid, and what are the terms of the payment. The trial court similarly found that things like in what entity was the defendant promised an interest, allegedly promised an interest, was absent from the complaint. If the plaintiff himself doesn't know what these details are, then they certainly would be discovered in later discovery. In this case, there are just four issues the court looks to. The first is, and as I indicated, the analysis starts with economic loss rule. As pleaded, this is a breach of contract case. The court looks to whether the independent duty arises that would allow tort claims to be pleaded as well. The answer to that, in defendant's view, is no. The same promise gives rise to all claims, so therefore the tort claims need to be dismissed. The second piece of the analysis is the contract sufficient enough to allow the court to provide a remedy? That's not an issue as to whether the contract was formed. It's an issue as to whether there's any remedy for breach of that contract. If the terms are not specific enough to allow the court to provide a remedy, then there's no remedy to be had, and the trial court properly dismissed that claim. The dismissal was based upon inability of the court to fashion any remedy, even if a breach were found, which indicates that the plaintiff didn't state a claim for relief. The court didn't go into, and defendants didn't argue about consideration, didn't argue about formation of the contract, simply argued about sufficiency in terms of providing a remedy. And finally, with respect to the wage claims, the reason the trial court dismissed the wage claims is that plaintiffs did not assert facts that would allow the trial court to conclude, even when viewing the facts as pleaded in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, that he was an employee. The facts that defendants presented in response to, or that defendants presented in the motion to dismiss, including the subcontract between plaintiff and the defendant all around Rouseabout, indicate that plaintiff was an independent contractor. He sent his own invoices. He was paid without tax withholding. In his response to the motion to dismiss, plaintiff didn't respond to these issues, and the trial court found that troubling, in addition to the fact that the complaint didn't plead sufficient facts to allow the court to conclude that plaintiff was an employee. So based upon these facts, the trial court correctly dismissed the wage claims. Thank you. If there are no other questions.
I think the problem with All Around's argument is that it is based on sort of a game theory of pleading. We have to plead it just so technically, and if we don't get it right, we're bounced out of court. But that concept of game theory pleading is about 100 years old. I mean, it was rejected about 100 years ago. Today, it's notice pleading, it's liberally construed, it's difficult in the Rule 12 set stage of a case to predict where the discovery is going to go. No, we don't have access to all of the evidence, for example. We don't have all of the access to all of the agreements among the various parties who are defendants and how they shifted or allocated responsibility, that sort of thing. It's important to remember in this case that we are still at the Rule 12 stage. And what we did was plead a complaint that was reasonable based on the information that we had. For example, the argument has been made that this wasn't really employment of will, it was an independent contract, but all of the information that was given to you in support of that argument was be outside the scope of the complaint. So under Rule 12 standards, I would submit to you that the trial court erred and this court should reverse.
Could you address the Rule 11 aspect of the dismissal? Maybe you were trying to touch on a little bit, but specifically what the court found and whether or not you you think that the basis for the court's ruling can be overturned under the abuse of discretion standard. It's pretty severe standard for us.
I think it can be and should be overturned under an abuse of discretion standard. I laid out the language from the complaint in 2-3 pages on the reply brief, page 5, 6, 7. And I think where the trial court got caught up was very early in the complaint, I try and sort of define the identities of parties and then go through without having to repeat all of the individual defendants every time I made a single allegation in the complaint. Actually, my partner did the complaint. But so that process sort of got lost, and that's why I pulled it back out for the purposes of the reply. I think it's plain error, and that constitutes an abuse of discretion. And certainly, throwing the entire case out under those circumstances was an excessive punishment under the circumstances. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your excellent arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.